Thank you for that introduction. Good afternoon. So the objectives for my presentation today are to describe the mumps epidemic in Arkansas starting in August 2016 up till present day. I'll also describe some previously undescribed, some unusual clinical observations that we saw during this outbreak. I'll also discuss our control measures that were implemented, as well as the challenges that we face in controlling this outbreak. So, how did the second largest mumps outbreak in U.S. In the past 30 years start? And so, like any other outbreak, it started on a Friday. That was the day that our index case developed peritonitis. We were notified on Monday, and we had obtained a buccal swab and sent it off to the state public health lab, where it was confirmed that it was indeed mumps. This was a Marshallese adult woman who lived in Springdale, Arkansas. She worked in a nursing home in the community, and she also attended a very large Marshallese church. And so we're a little concerned about exposures in her case, but this was just one case. To our disdain, her spouse had an onset of peritonitis a couple of weeks later. He worked at a manufacturing facility in the area and also attended the same large Marshallese church. And at this point, we had learned anecdotally that this family had a relative who traveled to Iowa with their two children, and on the way back to Arkansas, they had developed symptoms of mumps, and this was about 2 weeks out from the onset of the index case, so we like to blame our outbreak on Iowa. I know a lot of other states blame it on us, but, you know, give it a take. Within the next week, we had at least 13 additional suspect cases reported to us. It can go up to 20 maybe, but we weren't really collecting our data systematically at that point. But 15 cases is 3 to 4 times more than our state average on a yearly basis. And so we're a bit concerned this would get out of control. So we had asked for CDC's help and assistance. And so the next week, an FBA team arrived, thanks Mo, and they had helped us with our data collection and also our outbreak response processes. And also on that same day, we somehow convinced the church that we were seeing ongoing transmission, there were a few cases from that church, to do a vaccine clinic, and we gave around 80 doses to church members on that day. In 2 more weeks, our case count reached 180, almost 200. If we assume these are 3 generations, then the R naught was around 10. And so our outbreak was steadily increasing at this point. And so also on that day, we did a mass MMR clinic at a local community center where the Marshallese tended to hang out. But at this point, the infections had spread outside of the Marshallese community into schools and workplaces. And so that was also the day that our FBA team left. They came back, but they... our initial outbreak setting, as I said, was in Springdale, Arkansas. Just to give you a little context, Arkansas is a population of 3 million people. Springdale is in Washington County in northwest Arkansas, and that has a population around 216,000. And so getting into the Marshallese, the U.S. and the Marshall Islands have a sort of bad history. During the Cold War, the U.S. used the Marshall Islands as a weapons base and tested several nuclear bombs off their islands. And so in the 80s, an international agreement called the Compact of Free Association was established to settle all claims arising from these nuclear tests. And so this agreement allows the Marshallese to come to the U.S. to live and work freely just on a passport. And they've kind of settled into Arkansas and made that their home because of our large poultry industry there. So there's around an estimated 10,000 to 12,000 Marshallese that live in northwest Arkansas, which is the largest in the continental U.S. They have a unique culture. They are a matriarchal society, very community oriented, but they typically live in dense, crowded housings where up to 15 to 20 people can live in a 3-bedroom home. which can be great for viruses to spread. They're highly mobile. Kids tend to move around with family members or with friends of the family and at any given time. And we've also learned that churches serve as a focal point for all social activities, and so there are little communities within the community. So this is an epic curve of all of our cases since the beginning, and I've done it by week of illness onset. And so 56% of our cases were confirmed by PCR, and that's in the darker gray. The lighter gray are our probable cases. But as you noticed, I've also plotted cases by race, ethnicity. And so in the beginning of the outbreak, the Marshallese accounted for 70 to 80% of our cases. But after the new year, there are less Marshallese cases and more non-Marshallese cases. In the past few weeks, we've had zero cases, but we're very cautious. We're crossing our fingers and hoping that this outbreak is almost over. And so looking at the distribution of cases around Arkansas, so we have 75 counties, and out of those counties, 37 had at least one case a month, which is about 50% of the state. We've also had 101 schools in 22 school districts, which, and also 16 private schools, 13 colleges and vocational schools, 183 businesses, and 160 churches that had at least one case a month. And then the top four counties I listed, Washington, Benton, and Carroll, are in northwest Arkansas, and then Greene County is in northeast Arkansas, and they accounted for 93% of all cases. And so the red counties are those that have an active case or a case that had peritonitis within the last 26 days. The ones in gray are those that are inactive. So looking at age and vaccination status of our cases, we had an age range of 4 months to 82 years, a median age of 15, and our highest age group was the 5 to 17-year-olds or school-age children. But within that school-age children category, 92% were up to date on their MMRs, so they had two doses. All of these investigations and cases were verified for their vaccination status. So we use the state immunization registry to verify vaccination status. This registry has incomplete data for adults since we just started retaining adult immunizations within the past 5 years. And so the 37% for the adults is underestimating how many were up to date. But overall, we had at least 70% of our cases were up to date on vaccine. And looking at complications, so serious complications were rarely seen in mumps cases before the introduction of the vaccine, but they have been particularly rare during the post-vaccination era. Pre-vaccination, one-third of post-pubertal boys or men develop orchitis, and one-third of those develop infertility. So that was a serious concern. We've approximated that with the number expected with 3,000 cases, but what we observed was 1 to 2% of that expected count. And so we've only observed 19 complications in total. 18 of those were orchitis and one pancreatitis case, and we had 6 hospitalizations. And so although just the vaccine doesn't appear to have prevented a majority of the breakthrough peritonitis, it did seem to be highly effective in preventing serious complications within our cases. And getting into the unusual or the previously undescribed clinical observations. And so based on the literature and per CDC, patients are infectious 3 days prior to 4 days post-peritonitis onset. With our cases, we found that 75 were confirmed by PCR greater than 5 days after peritonitis onset. And looking at those cases, they had an age range of 2 to 4 to 6 years. Most were Marshallese, 65%, 57% were female, and then almost 70% received at least 2 doses of MMR. And recognizing that PCR positivity doesn't always mean infectivity, we had sent 10 samples to CDC for viral culture, and they were all positive for the virus, so we found that interesting. Also, we also saw something else unusual. A typical mumps case usually has only unilateral peritonitis on one side, but occasionally within a week they may develop additional peritonitis on the opposite side. We saw 22 cases with recurrent onset of clinical peritonitis, whether that was on one side and then the other side or on the same side, and that had a range of 31 days to 185 days after the first episode of peritonitis. And so looking at those cases, the age range was 5 months to 42 years. A majority were Marshallese, 82%, 59% were female, and then 68% received at least 2 doses of MMR. An additional handful of cases had recurrent peritonitis from 2 weeks to a month the first episode, but that wasn't included here. And so getting into our control measures, we did perform a lot of MMR clinics. We conducted 71 community, church, employer, and school-based clinics. Most of those were to get individuals up to date with age-appropriate vaccination. A subset of those were to provide a third dose booster in settings with ongoing transmission, and those were mostly in schools. We have started some analyses with CDC, but those will not be complete until the outbreak is officially over to look at the effectiveness of doing the third dose booster. And so in total, we've given roughly over 8,700 doses of MMR. 42% were in schools, 35% were in work sites like the poultry factory or other industry, and then 23% were in community settings, so like grocery stores, churches, at our local health units, and as well as we went door to door and gave vaccine in apartment buildings and things like that. And so we did a very crude analysis looking at the booster vaccine effectiveness. And so this analysis we restricted to students who already had 2 MMR doses and attended the first 21 schools where we had conducted vaccine clinics. And so we wanted to look at the preclinic rate of mumps, so how many cases of school-age children had mumps, and then we looked at the period of the first incubation period after the clinic and then the second incubation after the clinic. And so before the clinic, there was a rate of 16.7, there was 278 cases of mumps in students before we had the vaccine clinic. There were 1,900 students that received the third dose booster, 14,000 did not. If we look at the middle, the first incubation period, we see that the rate within students who received the third dose was higher than the rate that did not receive the third dose. We speculate that's because of those who got the third dose selected themselves to get that booster because they were maybe exposed in the household or they were exposed at school, so they were more likely to get the third dose. And the vaccine cannot interrupt an incubation period, so if they're exposed, the vaccine wasn't going to help. If we look at the second incubation period, we see that there are only 2 cases within the students that received the third dose. And so we calculated that as a vaccine effectiveness of 61% compared to those who had only 2 doses. And again, this is crude, and we're working with CDC on more thorough and detailed analysis to look at vaccine effectiveness. And so during the outbreak, we used the traditional outbreak control methods. We communicated to various audiences. We sent out 3 EpiXs, and we communicated to providers and the community themselves, and provided clinics. We excluded students based on recommendations and things like that, but we soon found out that there are more things that we needed to do because this outbreak wasn't coming under control. And so we had to do some tailored community engagement methods. So initially, particularly with the Marshallese, we were not welcome into churches. So we did that one vaccine clinic in the beginning, but we had a harder time getting to other churches in the community. Many members of the community considered mumps as a low priority. It's a mild disease. If I get it, I won't get it again. Why do I need a vaccine? Also, they had other factors to consider, like socioeconomic status. So they want to go to work and things like that. They have other priorities, and mumps wasn't one of them. And then others pushed back due to perceptions of stigma. And so that was more intel that they were not well, and they would have to be isolated from their family, which is really important to them. So our solutions, we identified some community champions within the community to do some engagement. We had a medical mission team from the Republic of Marshall Islands come and help us engage with the community. They helped us set up a meeting with the pastors of the churches and the pastors' wives. So again, this is a matriarchal society, so we should have asked the pastors' wives instead of the pastors, because they were the ones that made all the decisions, which is fine. And then with CDC, we helped set up a Marshallese task force to help with the mumps outbreak response, but with other health issues as well. We had several different partners. One is our UAMS, which is our academic medical center, the only one in Arkansas. We partner with the Coalition of Marshallese in Arkansas. They're a really big help in being interpreters and like, translating materials for us. Again, the consulate and the Ministry of Health helped us. CDC and Walmart provided incentives to engage interpreters that we had to hire from the community. We also had a medical anthropologist there to gather data and engage with the community. And we also had to translate a lot of our materials into Marshallese. And then we also had a community Marshallese doctor who did some radio spots for us on the Marshallese radio station. And so we had several communication challenges. It was a massive outreach effort. We had to ask a lot of people to help us. So some of these are CDC's materials, and so different messages work for different audiences. So the selfies work for like teenagers and things like that. And then we had to use a multi-pronged and repetitive approach to get the word out there that mumps can be serious and you should be aware of it. And so that's the end of my presentation, but I would like to take the time to thank everyone who was involved in this outbreak response. There were hundreds of people and thousands of man hours during this response. So ADH staff, CDC staff that helped us, the RMI Consulate, Ministry of Health, the task force, the Coalition of Marshallese, our academic medical centers, community leaders, and et cetera. Thanks specifically to Dr. Haytham Safi and Dr. Dirk Hassel, who's a state epi, who helped create the slides. And I'd just like to acknowledge the CSCE fellowship program. Thank you.
Thank you, Virgie. Does anyone have a quick question? A couple of questions? Your state epi wants to know something.
Because nobody else stood up, I was going to ask a question. Could you give some examples of the cultural challenges that we ran into when we were working through this outbreak?
Sure. So with the Marshallese, birthdays are really important to them, and so particularly first birthdays. And so if someone is missing from a birthday party, if you're sick or you have to isolate yourself from the rest of the community, then you kind of get stigmatized. There's a barrier between because you're not involved in this birthday party and things like that. So that was one challenge, that people didn't want to isolate themselves from their family members, because, I mean, who really wants to isolate themselves? But when you're sick, you need to. So that was one big challenge.
Sina Korea, Kentucky. I have a quick question for you. I'm wondering if you've had a chance to look into the age distribution for those who had recurrence of parotiditis, and also if they had any underlying medical conditions, and if you ruled out any other viral infections, including flu.
Oh, okay. Well, we have looked into the age distribution of those. I don't have that information on the top of my head, but I can look that up into our mumps. We're writing a paper right now, and it's probably in my paper. And if the second question was about underlying conditions. We did not look into any underlying conditions. Particularly in the Marshallese, they have a high burden of other diseases like diabetes, high blood pressure, hypertension, and things like that. So that would be something interesting to look into. And then with flu, coincidentally, during the flu period, after the new year, There are a few samples, negative samples for mumps that the buccal swabs that we sent to the state health lab. We tested some of the negative samples for flu as well, and half of those came back positive for flu. So at some point in the outbreak, in the period of time, flu was also circulating at the same time, and it was causing peritonitis in our patients. I don't know if Dirk has anything to add.
Yeah, so we're actually going to conduct a study to try to estimate the prevalence of flu-related peritonitis over the season because we observed this being surprisingly high. We did look at other medical conditions among the Marshallese, and nothing really popped out, although the Marshallese, half of Marshallese adults have diabetes. More than half have undiagnosed hypertension. They are troubled with an enormous burden of chronic disease, and we think that may relate to these unusual clinical appearances, that they may be relatively immune compromised compared to the general population.
Thanks.
Thanks, Virgie. That was excellent. And I know a tremendous effort from Arkansas to get this under control. So my question is about the Marshallese, which is a close-knit community with high rates of mumps, is almost centered in this hesitancy community around it. That's my understanding, that there's exemption rates. And I was curious if you learned anything from the outbreak, why it didn't really spill over too much into that community.
That's a good question. I'm honestly not sure. I don't know if Dirk has any hypotheses about that, but... intense exposures.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.